So let me just tell you this straight out, and then maybe I'll save you a little reading, and we can have a discussion about it in any case. Okay, so the chapter begins. This is a chapter that tells a story about bread and the relationship between bread nutrition and bread satisfaction. So we've got a guest. This is our gastronomy day of the week, right? So we're looking. We're back to Dan Barber, and so the chapter opens with a story about tomato fungus. So tomato fungus happen to plants, right? Some varieties are more susceptible to funguses than others. And in this case, the fungus was really bad because it was distributed in an industrial way by lots of tractor trailer trucks loaded with tomato plants, right? So in an industrial food system, you can have, the point for your notes is that you can have big effects from a blight because you're using an industrial system to distribute plants. So if the plants have a disease or weakness, especially something that's airborne like funguses, these funguses travel 40 miles. You have to imagine these tractor trailers going all through New England full of plants, spewing spores of these funguses everywhere, right? So this was a major problem. I didn't get the year date on there. And so this is a way of introducing the point that behind our crops, this is a huge point, let's appreciate this. Behind our crops, there's a whole world of plant breeding going on. And traditionally, right? So the big example I've given you is 5000 BC, Mesoamerica. Plant breeders figure out, probably in about a 10-year period, without any knowledge of genetics, how to create modern corn from the skimpy little corn cobs that are, you know, like this big and have a few kernels on them. We get these huge corn cobs now. So those are monsters. In a way, they're monstrosities of the plant world, just like chickens that we breed with, you know, huge breast meat and no strong bones. I mean, so these plants are, in one sense, monstrosities in relation to their originals. But the point is that you can't have a food system, a modern, even ancient agriculture, but certainly modern agriculture depends upon teams of people who are doing plant breeding on an ongoing basis. You don't just breed a seed and then say, okay, this is good for the next 300 years, because conditions change and you might be farming in different places and so on. So it turned out that Stone Hill or whatever it's called, Stone Farm, the restaurant was hit by the fungus, but these Mountain Magic tomatoes, they were bred by some people in New York at Cornell to resist blight fungus. So then we meet the Cornell breeders of this variety, and they say something really stunning, which I'm kind of regretting that you guys didn't get a chance to read this. So Barber wants to meet the people who make the Mountain Magic tomatoes because they survived the blight. They don't taste as good as the variety that was blighted. But he wants to meet the breeders, so they meet these people from Cornell, and the plant breeder says, "I've never been asked to breed a plant for flavor," and that's a pretty remarkable thing. Plant breeders at land grant universities tend to be trying to increase yield. Okay, so the point for your notes would be that Barber's raising the question about whether we can use plant breeding knowledge and technology to breed for flavor. And that leads him to, it gives you a little background on the land grant system, and maybe some of you know some of this, but this is really important. It's one of the best things this country did in food. And since we've said a lot of negative things about the U.S. food system, I really want to call attention to this. Back when we created the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1862, we created seed banks and we created a land grant institutions, right? So state universities, typically that had agriculture schools, were connected with this, and these operated seed banks and they operated plant breeding programs in the public interest for that state. So since conditions vary geographically, the idea was we want really expert plant breeders all over the country breeding varieties of plants that help farmers in those places. Brilliant, right? And it worked. It was good. And that led to the experiment station and the extension service. How many of you come from rural areas where you know what an extension agent is? Have you ever Have you ever heard of that? So the ag extension agents are people who have expertise, and they go out to farmers and they help them with their problems. And they also bring news about new varieties of plants. They bring news about regulatory issues. Basically, it's a kind of it's a really brilliant way to connect knowledge and learning about plants to the farmers. And so that's kind of in the background, because you're going to need to meet Steve Jones, and here's where the story gets thicker. Okay, there's a variety of wheat called Aragon 3, which was almost wiped out in Spain, and because the Spaniards went for this more industrial variety, but this small group, I think it was just a few farms maybe, kept growing it, and it became really popular because it tasted better than the industrial wheat that other people were farming. So this is the point for your notes. This raises the possibility of wheat being a local fresh ingredient. That's a pretty radical change in perspective. Remember, we learned about the roller mills and how the roller mills make it possible to make those big sacks of wheat that you buy for £5, for cheap, and they don't taste, there's not much taste. So Barber is kind of asking, well, just like the Mountain Magic tomatoes, can we get wheat that's both nutritious and really tasty? And maybe the way to think about it is that the wheat has to be a fresh product. And that's, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I didn't grow up thinking of wheat as a fresh product at all. In fact, one of the brilliant things about cereals is that they can be stored. But the idea is that if you're gonna move to a plant-based diet, you really wanna jack up satisfaction from all your plant-based foods. And so you shouldn't just write off the gastronomy of your bread, right? So here's what you learn about Steve Jones. He was at WSU down here in Pullman most of his career. Then he had this fateful meeting with some executives from Monsanto who came to WSU as they did to land grants. How do they do to land grant schools around the country? And here's the problem. The best seed banks are at the land-grant schools, so the corporations need land-grant programs to get access to seeds. And so what they, in 1982, we passed a law that encouraged the Baugh-Dole Act. I think it's 1980. The Baugh-Dole Act, which encouraged collaboration between companies like Monsanto and land-grant seed programs. And by the 90s, the majority of the funding for our land-grant seeds comes from private industry. The reason that's problematic is that when Monsanto went to WSU and Steve Jones, here's their proposal. You help us develop better varieties. Your program shares in the licensing agreements. These are going to be genetically modified seeds. The farmers will not be able to own the seeds. You know that story, right, from earlier in the semester. And Steve Jones says, no, I can't do that. And everybody's doing that. Okay, so the point for your notes is Steve Jones breaks with this industrial GMO seed model, which has, according to this chapter, sucked in basically all the land grants programs in the country. And turn them into really serving the public interest through serving corporate interests to increase yields. So again, you've got this idea that they didn't come and say, help us grow a really tasty wheat plant. What they said is, help us make a wheat plant that resists Roundup, right? That's what they want. And as you know, there's this big cancer case going forward on Roundup. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to paint too negative a picture. There's actually one of the readings that didn't get into the course was that Monsanto was actually doing some interesting stuff with organic varieties. So I don't want to make Monsanto the demon all the time. But in this case, in the narrative here, the meeting doesn't go well. And he hangs on. He's a tenured faculty member, but he's pretty much ostracized at this point. He's not going with the program. So what they do is they make him the head of this... they make him the head of this Washington State Research and Extension Center because he's a genius geneticist. I mean, he's like really good at doing this. And so what he does is he moves from the east side of Washington State to the west, and in the process he meets these wheat farmers in Skagit Valley, and they show him they're growing wheat for these specialty markets in North Korea that value this certain kind of wheat for a specialty noodle. So they're growing wheat in the Skagit Valley, and they're making a lot of money on it. And here's the important point for your notes. They're using wheat as a rotation crop, which in industrial agriculture you wouldn't tend to do unless that's all you were growing, because it wouldn't seem economical. But if this wheat is going to a specialty market because people are prizing this variety of wheat for its flavor and its protein levels, then you can make money on it as a rotation crop. Yeah.
Tell me, you know more about this than I do.
Yes. Oh, here's from Skagit Valley.
Yes, I'm from the Skagit Valley area.
Okay.
And I pass this all the time at my grandparents' house.
Oh, tell me.
And I always was wondering, like, why don't they use all of the area, all of the land? And because they rotate through like 5 different sections, at least that's what I've seen.
Okay. In the valley, you mean?
Over the valley.
Okay.
Like just in this one industrial farm that I've seen. But it definitely makes sense now. But you can see it from the highway.
Oh, were they doing rotation, you think?
Yeah.
Right. That's
yeah,
neat.
And so
yeah.
I would see like every different season it would be a different piece of land. And so I was wondering
why
I was glad that they were doing it, but I was wondering like why don't they just use it all? But that's cool that they're
The key to this equation, that's good. I'm glad you brought in that connection. I want to see it too. The key to this equation is to value the crop that we formerly treated as pure commodity, to value it in a way that it comes back into the farming system. And that requires something on the consumer end, right? Taking bread seriously, and then that enables you to use the crop as a rotation crop, which is pretty cool. So that's what he gets excited about. And he meets with these Skagit Valley farmers, and they say, well, you know, he wants to work with them. He says, look, I'm just coming in to set up this to work at this extension center, which was kind of a demotion, but you know, he's turned it into, as I showed you, that's where the bread lab is. He's turned it into this mecca for people who are serious about wheat. He meets the farmers, and they say, at the end of the meeting, they say, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, you're this cool geneticist. We want your help with these varieties. But one thing for sure is you cannot license this seed. This has to stay public. And so the exact opposite of the story that he has with Monsanto. So it's a really nice career story, right? You're getting it? Okay, very nice narrative moment with the farmers and Jones. And so the conclusion I'm drawing from this story back to philosophical method is that if you take the product seriously as a gastronomic experience, it could be that farmers can get enough money for it to value it, and so the food system can be upgraded at that level. A couple of interesting details. At one point, Barber says to Jones, you know, well, can you get flavor and yield at the same time? And this is something that maybe if you've come from an agricultural area, you know already. It was news to me. And he said this is the plant geneticist talking. He said, that's really hard to do with plants that have been domesticated to become bigger and full of water. Like, you know, a lot of our varietals are designed to get bigger products that look perfect and hold up to transportation. He said, it's hard, the flavor yield trade-off is harder in plants that have been selected for size and water because they're full of water. So it's hard to ramp up the flavor because it's getting diluted. But with wheat, he said, in principle, you could get flavor and yield at the same time because you're not fighting the water. And I thought that was an interesting detail. An interesting connection between nutrition and satisfaction today is that Jones claims that older wheats had higher levels of nutrition, and not just protein, but also micronutrients. You know, as you know, you take up a lot of minerals in wheat. Okay, so I'm sorry this is your first time hearing this, but any thoughts about that? Questions about that? Have any of you encountered specialty wheat in this form or? What do you think? You feel like you get the point of the story. Part of the reason for having this chapter in here is just acquaint you with this idea that behind the agriculture system, there's this huge, we depend on this whole system of breeders, plant geneticists in this case, and I guess, you know, I'd add this to your notes. The values that the plant breeders are working with materially affect the quality of the farming system, right? So they're, the way Barbara puts it is they're writing the first recipe. You know, he's the chef, but the first recipe comes from the variety of the food you're working with. So sourcing, we've talked about sourcing in a couple of different ways, but here we're talking kind of about sourcing for satisfaction, but notice that also can include sourcing for higher nutrition. Okay, so the contrasting story today is the chapter from Moss, and I really was really excited to have this in the course because this is, you get to meet some famous, so on the one hand you've got Steve Jones, and you're seeing why how I set this up. On the one hand you've got Steve Jones, who's pursuing flavor in varietals as a wheat breeder, plant geneticist, and he's just incredibly cool. And then you've got this really cool guy, Howard Moskowitz, who is like a rock star of the food science industry. I mean, this guy is amazing. You know, he's the guy who figured out he figured out cherry vanilla Dr. Pepper. I mean, come on. That's like, do you guys drink stuff like that? I don't know. That might not have been, see, because that happened when you guys were really young. I don't know, are you Dr. Pepper people?
It's really good.
It's really good. That's great. And so what? So this reading you know better, but so I wanted you to meet two food science rock stars and contrast them for the kind of ways that they're pursuing gastronomy and nutrition in food, because I think it gives you the starkest picture. And I don't mean to, they're both incredibly accomplished people, right? So I don't mean to run either one down. So what do we owe to Moskowitz? Maybe you guys can help me with this. Moskowitz is one of the people that invented the idea of product line extension. Does anybody remember that? Maybe you guys can help get me off the hook a little bit by supplying some of these. Do you have the article handy? Try to bring the articles to class. Product line extension is what you see every day in the supermarket when a product that initially shows up on the shelf then develops varieties, right? So product line extensions are flavor variations, size variations, nutritional variations, low salt, low sugar, whatever. So the argument, the point is that product line is a competitive method of getting shelf space, because if you can get into what's going on in the supermarket, I don't know if you guys, who's here from a business background? Yeah, a few of you. I don't know if this comes up or it's part of your general knowledge, but supermarkets are incredibly competitive places for product suppliers. And shelf space is the measure, because shelf space gets people's attention, right? So product line extensions are ways of extending shelf space. But it turns out they're also ways of saving products. So one of Moskowitz's early victories, and you hear about this guy's career, one of his early victories was when he went to work with help out Maxwell House, and he figured out they wanted a new, their sales were flagging, and they said, "Come on, need to come up with a new flavor, a new roast." Right? He's the first person who figured out from the tasting. So he does a lot of scientific data tasting, as you know, and he's the first person to figure out that you needed different roasts for coffee. There were people who you it wasn't just a question of finding the new roast. It was like there were people's coffee tastes actually could be split up, and you could actually monetize, just like we monetize your attention on a computer screen at a website. You can monetize the demographics of taste, right? So you can say, well, the demographics for coffee drinkers is there's and we know this now. This is like so obvious now that you have this explosion in different kinds of roasts that different people can take to and really get into, right? So it's kind of a cool story. So back to Moskowitz's earlier career, though. He's this Harvard guy, does research, he's getting a PhD in food psychology, I think it was. And in the military, he had an interesting challenge what do you learn about in this chapter? Anybody? What's the problem in military rations? It's hard to get soldiers to eat them because they suck, right? They don't taste good. And if you've got soldiers fighting a war and they're not eating food, you've got a serious problem, right? So we've run into this historically where soldiers would be, you know, suffering from diseases of nutrition. Now we can solve that problem, but it's hard to deliver interesting food to people. And he figures out that part of the problem is that there's this phenomenon called sensory-specific satiety, which is that if you put a really strong flavor in the rations to kind of keep people interested, it can actually overwhelm someone's appetite, and which is actually not a problem if you're trying to cut calories. But what he figured out is that if you just put a lot of sugar in the rations, people will eat them up. Kind of a simple solution. So some people say there's no bliss point for sugar. There is actually a bliss point for sugar, but you know, the point is that it's higher than a lot of other flavors. So the point for your notes would be that you can reach sensory specific satiety quicker with other flavors than sugar, with other sensations than sugar. Sugar has a very high bliss point. So if you're trying to get people to eat more food, you put more sugar in it, right? And I don't know if you guys eat Prego. This is a horror of the food industry as far as I'm concerned. Prego tomato sauce is I don't know what the current level is. You'd have to check because these things change, right? But it's a tomato. Do you guys like Prego? I'm sorry. Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it's really sweet, though, right?
Yeah.
You can skip your Pepsi that day because it's in the tomato sauce, right? No, I don't know. I don't know how much it is, but it's good stuff.
I was just reading the nutrition facts like the other day, and it's between 8 and 10 grams of sugar
a serving. Is it really? For a serving on top of some pasta? That's a lot of sugar. You want to consider switching brands?
I'm not that loyal to it.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. So 8 to 10 grams of sugar, right? Sugars, how many calories per gram? That's pretty serious. I don't know. It might fit into your diet fine. So this is the guy who brought a kind of science to figuring out the optimal points of for different flavors, and the cherry vanilla Dr. Pepper solution is kind of a good example of that. And then they're meeting at a lunch place in White Plains, New York. Where, I mean, he's probably fantastically rich, and he's like very healthy eater. He doesn't like eating any kind of industrial foods. He's like, oh, that's gross. Because the barber orders some. Moss. Orders some Dr. Pepper. This is the guy who figured out cherry vanilla Dr. He's going to want Dr. Pepper. He's like, oh, I don't drink that stuff. And he takes a sip of it, and he goes, oh, that's horrible. And he can actually taste the benzyl, I didn't spell it right. He can actually taste the chemical. He said, yeah, they use this chemical to achieve this flavor. And so he's just a really interesting story about, you know, he's a giant of food science management. What do you think? How do these two stories help you think about food and satisfaction from food? Yeah.
It connects to the documentary my group watched at the beginning of the year, Fed Up.
Yeah. Good.
And how much I think like the big food industries take advantage of this, like sugar.
Absolutely.
They capitalize on sugar to sell the food, especially to kids, which I just don't think is very ethical.
Right, right.
I think it's interesting that, like, despite all the research that is out there, and I feel like over the years they've made it more attainable to people that are just, like, your average American citizen.
What do you mean by attainable?
Like, when you're buying stuff from the store, they'll have, like, more facts presented.
Right.
Or, like, they'll have the campaign ads on, like, they're still marketed towards, like, buying the Cheerios or the Frosted Wheats, but it's still, like, I think they're doing more to say, like, sugar might be bad or...
Well, sometimes they'll drop comments about sugar and kind of like, you're right, there's a lot of sophisticated messaging going on those boxes, and they're changing all the time, and that's part of what it's a good point. I mean, there's this, we're using all this knowledge about our psychology of food to signal consumers in the effort to do sales, which is exactly what companies are supposed to do, increase their sales. But again, we have that paradox of selling more food and keeping people healthy. Yeah, good start. Thanks. Others? Yeah, please.
It's interesting because when I went abroad, a lot of my friends that I met there always commented on how sweet the American bread was. It's nothing I'd ever noticed before, but then comparing their bread with like, the bread I grew up with,
absolutely. Absolutely.
It is a lot sweeter. So.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But
yeah.
We're like so used to it, we didn't even notice.
It's also, you know, you got, I've encouraged you guys to do these taste comparisons. It's also the way sweetness comes out. In, so, like, if you compared an artisan bread with an industrial bread, they're going to both have sweetness in it, but in the course of just eating a bite, you'll have a different profile for the sweetness. And so, yeah, that's good. And Europeans do comment on that. They're surprised. They comment on their travel to, in the U.S. and how sweet food is.
One thing that, like, my friend Lucy also said, like, they focused on a lot was how much cinnamon we put in things.
Oh, interesting.
Like, they were very aware of the fact that there's cinnamon, like, things that were unnecessarily.
Yeah.
And I never noticed, right. And it took me a long time to realize, like, yeah, there's the cinnamon in that, too.
Is it, you know, this is where I'm going with this. Food cultures have almost palates. Like, there's an American palate. That's cultivated from the foods we eat, and I have this kind of pet theory that you can actually shift your palate. I don't know if you guys have any experience that would relate to this, but you know, one place to look is when, you know, this scene where you can't stand the sodas. Like, if you move, some of you have changed your diets even before you took this course, right? And when you change your diet, the things that you used to get excited about eating don't taste the same. You could still get excited about eating them sometimes, and you could recover that desire to taste them, but does that make sense? Does anybody relate to that? I'm getting some nods? Yeah.
When I like cut out meat in my diet or like try to eat more plant-based food, you stop craving it after a while.
You do.
And you just like crave other things instead.
You do. Yeah. You're so palate shift is my amateur term for this idea that you can move your palate more toward the Howard Mark Moskowitz's of the world, or you can move them more toward the Steve Joneses of the world. And that's, and I think that's a really huge practical lesson. Yeah.
Growing up, I craved a lot of sugar, just because sugar was always offered in the house.
Right.
And at friends' house and parties and things
right.
like that. So I started changing my diet in college and ended up eating more plant-based foods and healthier meat and things like that. And now I don't really crave those. Instead, if it's something sweet, it's usually like fruit or something like
right.
that.
Right, right. I try to get my sugar from fruit. I mean, so for instance, if palate shift is right, then putting down a couple of sodas at full sugar strength would likely make other foods you eat seem not sweet enough, right?
Yeah, and like I grew up drinking soda, and I've been soda free for
I don't
years.
Think,
now.
Yeah,
just because I no longer right. crave it. No longer.
That's an interesting single experiment you can do. Slightly related, I did an experiment like that years ago with caffeine, and I succeeded. I got past the 30-day mark, which is when they say that your addiction stops. And I looked myself in the mirror and said, I don't like you as much as the caffeinated self. So, you know, really, I did. I came to this conclusion that I succeeded, but I became a different person, and I found myself a little boring, actually, without caffeine. So I mean, you could do this experiment and still kind of draw your own conclusions, because you're going to feel different on a high-sugar diet. And okay, great. Good luck. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So you're going to feel different on a high-sugar diet. And one of the things I'd really like you to try to do at a phenomenal level is really get in touch with how the presence of different things in your diet like that make you feel. And so sometimes you need to experiment over several weeks. Yeah. Others? Yeah. Good discussion. Yeah.
I've been really intolerant for like a while, and I mentioned in my late diary, like
right.
I just decided to ignore it for so long.
Right.
But once I started saying like, no, I can't have that, it was more of like my desire to eat it was more of a practicality thing than an actual like taste thing. Like
right.
I don't really care for the bread. Like it's not like I just want a piece of bread. It's more of like a
right.
like, rather be able to go to the restaurant and say, like, I can have that.
Right.
Like, anything else.
Right.
Because, like, everything's wrapped in bread. Like, there's
right. Right.
Gluten wraps, there's, like, sandwiches, there's, like, the Big Mac that sticks an unnecessary piece of bread in the middle. So,
right, right,
just,
right. right.
A lot, and, like, it's present everywhere. It's
absolutely.
Like, saying, no, I can't, as opposed to, like.
Absolutely. That's one, practicality is one of the biggest problems to address in any kind of food shift. Because not just with restaurants, but also just, you know, when you think about making dinners, it's really easy to imagine bread in there. And so how has that worked for you? What have you used instead? Do you could use gluten-free bread?
Yeah, it doesn't taste taste the same.
Yeah.
But it's like it's grown on me. I know the difference. Yeah. I can like appreciate it more now because like mm-hmm. I can actually have that like satisfying like peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah.
But it took a while.
Yeah.
And I would just avoid it entirely until like I got accustomed to the taste and I was like, it's an acquired taste.
Right.
Same with like soy milk. When I first started drinking soy milk, I was like, this is the end of like this
right.
is the end
right.
of this.
Right. Right. Yeah. I'd rather die.
Yeah. But now, like, I could not imagine going back because I used to drink a glass of milk like at dinner every single day when I was growing up, and then hitting college and realizing I'm lactose intolerant, it was this like huge dynamic in my like life that switched, and I have those like cases of soy milk that don't need to be refrigerated until I open them, and I think it's like a really weird comparison because
right.
it's like watery soy milk.
Right.
I mean.
Right.
But it tastes better now.
No, these are good examples, because you know sometimes you have to engineer a new food in your diet because the other foods are really making you sick or they're not working for you, and it's the same problem. You have to solve the practicality problem, and you have to solve the satisfaction problem, and you have to keep an eye on the nutrition while you're doing that. So some of the things we swap out have nutritional problems, or they change the nutritional profile of the food. So yeah, good, absolutely.
Going off that mm-hmm. for like alternative milks, I looked at hemp milk for a little bit.
Oh yeah.
Interested, but it's very sweet.
Is it?
It's full of sugar. So
added sugar or no?
Yeah, added sugar as well. At least the one that I looked at. I don't think it was necessarily the best quality.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, just because it was just at, like my work that I looked
sure.
at, so I just went and looked and. It was like 20 grams per serving or something like that. Or
wow, that is
grams.
A lot.
And I was thinking, like, that's pretty much your entire, like, sugar intake for
yeah.
the day.
Yeah, pretty
so,
close.
So,
yeah.
for one serving. And
yeah,
usually
yeah.
people get more than one serving.
Yeah, those are important things to keep an eye on. Yeah, so that's another similar example where you shift a product to solve a problem or move in a certain direction in your diet. And so you pick up other issues,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, good. Absolutely good. Others? This is good. Seems like the comparison might be standing out, even though I blew it with the reading. I'm really sorry about that. So yeah, I want to encourage you guys to do. People are coming forward with different ideas for small projects. It's completely up to you if you have time to do that. But there's some really practical things you can do. And one thing, I'll just close the class on this, is to just pick a. I was thinking about like what would be an example of a product that you might do this with, and then I'll give you an example of something from my diet. So this is a brand that you guys have seen in some stores. It's actually a tuna from Thailand, so there's an issue there maybe, but what you could do is take a, this would be an example. If you look at a can of this tuna, they sell this at like Huckleberry's and Main Market, so this will be in like your Whole Foods store. So this would, if you compare this, how many of you grew up eating like Sunkist tuna out of a can, right? That's kind of a standard industrial tuna. If you buy a can of Sunkist and you buy a can of this, you could compare them on a lot of different levels. You can compare them on taste levels. I had a friend who did this and said that they went back to Sunkist because that's what they grew up on and their palate was geared to that. And it's interesting to think, it's all tuna. Like, why is it that... But the Sunkist is actually a lot mushier. I think the meat quality here is better. This is understated here. There's tons of labels on it. If you pick up a can of this, I was going to bring a can in, there's like 7 or 8 different certifications on here. So it's just a simple example of a project you could do, an optional project if you're interested in. Pick something in your diet like this that you grew up on a certain product that has a profile. In this case, Starkist tuna isn't making any promises about how the tuna is caught, whether it's sustainable, or even the nutritional qualities of it. And so you could research the labels on the product because those labels are trying to communicate something good to you. I don't know if there is anything like sustainable tuna fishing. I'm suspicious of that. I've read some things that say there's nothing sustainable about our fish harvesting, but there's clearly some things that are relatively worse than other things. Like in ethics class yesterday, we were talking about the U.S. effort to stop buying shrimp from people who use net catches that catch sea turtles, which are beautiful animals, and which I was so taken with, I had to put on my website when we were talking about them. So you get all these claims. So you're going to see like tuna that says it's dolphin safe. This claims to be dolphin safe. wild, sustainably caught. So, you know, you could pick something in your diet that you've been looking at, thinking about changing or upgrading, and then make the price comparison, too. This is a lot more expensive than a can of Sunkist tuna. So that would be a neat thing that you could just do as an experiment personally, write it up, be a nice little optional short research paper or reflection paper. And it's in the spirit of, you know, it's in the spirit of today's class where we're comparing, we're comparing two different models, really, of designing and selecting food for flavor and nutrition and other characteristics. Okay, guys, why don't we stop there, if that's okay? And stick around if you have any questions or you want to talk about anything, and then I'll try to solve the reading problem. Sorry about that.
About our elimination diet review.
Yeah, what are you up for? What do you think about that?
Oh, I have been eating almost like 50%
of the year. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's big
stuff. Yeah, no, it's really, I really like it actually. I got past like the 2-week threshold where it was really, really hard.
Are you tracking nutrition pretty well?
I need to do more of that part of it. Yeah, that's.
Are you taking a supplement?
Yeah. I've been taking some vegetarian eaters. I've been taking a supplement that like basically covers everything already. So I don't think I'm lacking anything. Like, I actually feel really energized.
You feel, yeah, a lot of people report that. I mean, must feel really clean.
When I get back.
So that's great. I mean, that's a really substantial food experience to write about.
Yeah.
So yeah, is that what you want to track?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I really like it.
Yeah.
I like went to dinner last night with a girl who has been doing it for a year or two, and she told me she's like created a Facebook page for all the Gonzaga people who are, and like put them into a little group and stuff. So.
That's a great idea, partly because it's a very doable diet. You're making a lot of substitutes that might have flavor implications and nutrition implications, so it's kind of good to be in a group of people who are trading ideas about that.
It has like a lot of like things that I didn't expect would happen with it either, like because I can't really eat out as much and I can't get home a lot, so
right.
Like a lot of really good things have come from it that I just didn't think would.
No, I have a vegan friend, it's hard to go out to the restaurant.
It is, yeah.
So that is a challenge, but yeah, if you can. So you want to? Are you doing this? You've gone. How many weeks have you
really?
I really have been doing it. I started at spring break.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a good thing to write up. I'll
kind
of take your advice a little bit about the shape of it, because there's a lot of different things you could focus on, right? You could. I'd like to hear about the nutrition. I'd like to hear about, you know, but I also like to hear about how it felt, the level of satisfaction, you know, and practicality. I think there are some things about, like when I got meat out of my diet, in some ways it became a more practical diet. Because meat actually has, there's a lot of things you have to take care of. It doesn't stay fresh that long.
It's
expensive, right? So I'd like you to also, if you're interested, I'd like you to also tracks on the practicalities. It's like, okay, so is it less practical for going to a restaurant?
Yeah, well,
in some ways it's more practical because you're dealing with ingredients that your protein ingredients are stable.
I wanted to know, when is the like hard due date for that?
My goal with those kinds of assignments is just to make sure that they're not going to be away in finals for all of us, you know.
Yeah.
So I think end of April is good.
Okay.
That gives you a few more weeks to get experience on it.
Okay, good.
Good. I'm glad you're doing it. I'm glad it's going well.
Yeah.
Did you look at that? One article I recommend a lot for students who are going vegan is that article from the Academy of Dietitians. Did that get your
attention? So I live in the first group. Yeah. Pretty fun.
I thought the protein one from the textbook was interesting for it.
Good. That has, they referenced, I think they're referencing.
I've watched like a ton of documentaries.
Okay. Yeah. Are you going to?
This one came from
Phoenix? Yeah.
Nope.
Could you just not get a ticket, not get a flight, not get a ride?
It was expensive, and I also like my big thought process was it was insane here last week.
What it does is it just goes through the diet.
It's
probably tells you things you already know.
It would be crazy to
go
there.
Yeah, but
it
would be so much fun here. Are you going to go?
And basically,
it's
just
perfectly
doable.
Well, I just watch my house. I live with
the guy.
But it
does kind of
talk
about
it. That's really nice.
Compare what they say to what you're doing.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, like, all my roommates are
down. Yeah, good. I'm glad it's working out well.
Yeah,
good.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hang on,
well, I'll look forward to hearing
that. They're fans, so. Sorry.
Did you like it?
Yeah, they're fans,
yeah.
So I'll watch with them, I guess.
Form
like
those
one
studies.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
much.
So we're just going to go gamble
and
drink.
For Vlasic.
That'll be
sweet. I'm
yeah,
so excited.
Well, have a good weekend. See you later.
And he does the three categories of pickles.
Yeah.
Bitter, not so, but I just thought it was hilarious.
The detail I liked from his research methods is that he didn't want his test subjects comparing notes or talking about their experience that much because he thought that would like ruin it. So
yeah.
He wanted them to just answer the questions exactly as asked. So he's got this really scientific mentality about it, and he's pretty accomplished.
Yeah,
you know, he probably made millions doing this for these.
No,
people.
I don't drink.
He saved Jell-O. I can't remember what he did for Jell-O, but it was in a different chapter. But yeah, he's like one of these food rock stars.
Seriously though, there's like 12 companies that I know very well.
Yeah.
Like for him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So are you managing to contain your excitement?
Kind of, not really.
You have your viewing plan
worked out? Yes, 928 Cinto. It's a 120-inch projection screen that comes down 1080p. You are welcome there.
Thank you.
Seriously.
Right. That's
you are battering Chicago, Professor Madden.
He is in Seattle this weekend. He's with some Florence people who are in Seattle. Yeah. Yeah, so he's doing fun.
In the town. All right,
yeah, I got
Professor.
My group. All right, good
next
to see
time
you.
I see you, we'll be champions.
Yeah, I hope so.
That's the plan.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. So I had a question in that Kenneth brought up, I forget her name, when she's talking about lactose intolerance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been pretty curious. I mean, you've probably gathered from my stuff that I eat pretty much anything doesn't really affect me.
That's great.
But I know a lot of people, and I'm kind of curious, is that something that evolves over time? Because she said she had like a glass of milk every day when she was a kid.
Yeah, that surprised me. That part of her account surprised me because I thought if you were lactose intolerant,
you like had it your whole life.
Yeah.
Okay, so like I didn't want to call her out in class and say
it's an interesting question. I also a similar thing happens when I hear about people talking about gluten intolerance. They'll talk about how they've been eating bread all their life and then figured out they're gluten intolerant. I'm like, wow, what was that like? Were you getting sick all the time and just ignoring it? And I don't know. I've read some things that say that, like some industrial breads, they jack a lot of gluten in because there's a way to get, and it's good because it raises the protein level. But one article I read said that a lot of these subclinical gluten intolerances are coming from extra gluten that's been added to the products.
Okay.
But I don't know. So that could, you have to explain.
My fiance's older sister and her dad, her sister was always sick as a little kid, and then she found out when she was young that she was gluten intolerant he was hypoglycemic, so it was like a whole life thing, and she was all getting sick, and then once she cut it out, she felt great. But then her dad just kind of picked it up, and I always give him a hard time because he's like, oh yeah, like I'm gluten intolerant. I'm like,
you
started when you're 50 years old, like I don't know if that's like,
you know, there are people my age who will say that they discovered that, and I've also read skeptical accounts of that, because it turns out that there is a test for, what's that called when you have
hypoglycemia?
But there's a disease for gluten intolerance called, there's a name for it. And they can actually test to see if you have that celiac.
Celiac.
But there's subclinical celiacs, people who say they have gluten issues, but they fail this test. And some researchers are wondering how that could be true. Like, how could so many more people be coming forward saying they're gluten intolerant when the clinical definition of it doesn't?
And so,
you know what I mean?
What I was.
Yeah, so good things to wonder about.
But but the other thing I was talking about with him specifically is like every once in a while he's like, oh, that cookie looks really good, like I gotta have a bite and I'll do it. And it's like, if you're a celiac, you wouldn't be doing that, obviously.
Right. So that makes you more skeptical.
Then he does say that like if he does, you know, splurge and have, you know, like a bread or whatever, his stomach feels bad the next day, and I'm wondering if it might be something else.